Matt James
has joined the conference.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Matt James, Director of BioCenter, and I'm delighted to welcome you to the first call in BioCenter's Thought Leader teleconference series for 2011 through to 12, The Future of Humanity, Are We Ready for Humanity 2.0? And Brad, for you to be able to join with us. Just a couple of housekeeping details before we kind of get into the main conversation. As per the confirmation email you should have received from me, if we can keep our lines muted whilst the presentation is being made so that there's no extraneous sounds coming through and being duplicated through all the different lines that are connecting with this call, that would be gratefully appreciated. If you have a question or comment, please email it through to me before or at any point during the call, and then I will try and manage the flow of questions during the Q&A session, and I'll obviously indicate who I'd like to kind of call upon and in what order as we move into that Q&A session. So the email to contact me on is my personal email, which you should have all received confirmation details through, but it is, for the record, at matt.james@bioethics.ac.ca. One very important thing just to make clear, as with all our public events, the call will be recorded so that we can allow those who are unable to join us this afternoon to listen to the call at a later date, and it will be downloadable from our website. I can easily send out the link to everyone who participates this afternoon as well. Format-wise, we're just going to be working with these brief set of introductions, 10 minutes then given over to our guest speaker, Professor Fuller. Then we'll move into a Q&A session, and then I may well call upon Professor Fuller just to close with some comments and reflections before we end the call. So that's kind of the game plan, as it were, for this afternoon. A brief word perhaps just about BioCenter, for those of you who may be new to us. We have some familiar names as well as some new names joining us this afternoon, which is great. BioCenter is a think tank based in London, and we look at the ethical, social and political implications presented by new emerging technologies. However, probably unlike most think tanks, we're concerned as much about the conversation and how those questions are framed as we are about finding the answers. So in seeking to try and frame questions and host the conversation, our aim really is to try and bring together all articulate perspectives and viewpoints in order to try and establish a meaningful conversation and agree upon areas of consensus as well as understanding where different points may differ. So that's a little bit about us. The next event, we hold a series of public events as well as events like this. But our next event is, in fact, the second in this Thought Leader series, and that takes place on Friday this week, the 9th of December at 3 p.m. UK time. And when we've got one of the leading UK science fiction writers, Justina Robson, speaking on her views of the future from the perspective of a science fiction author, offering her thoughts and reflections on advances in robotics and AI and what she sees as being some of the key questions that we need to be considering and thinking about. So I know some of you that will be joining us this afternoon have already indicated you'd also like to join us for that telecon, and others are more than welcome to join as well. So details are available on our webpage, but also you can email me for those call details for later on this afternoon. Well, enough of the details of housekeeping and the practical side of things. Let's really move on now to our focus this afternoon, which we've entitled Preparing for Humanity 2.0. I'd just like to give a brief introduction to Professor Steve Fuller. Steve is an American philosopher and sociologist in the field of science and technology studies, where he currently holds the August Comte Chair in Social Epistemology in the Department of Sociology at the University of Warwick. He was originally trained in the history of philosophy of science, and he's closely associated with social epistemology. Particularly interested in the sociology of knowledge and history and philosophy and the sociology of science and issues relating to developments in science and technology, especially our changing perceptions of the biological and what it means to be human. And so clearly, I think an excellent speaker in kickstarting our discussions this afternoon on preparing for Humanity 2.0. And I must declare, I'm not employed by Steve, but his latest book was published very recently, within the last 2 months, I believe, and is entitled Humanity 2.0, What It Means to Be Human, Past, Present, and Future. And if you haven't been able to get hold of a copy, at least to peruse, not least read through, I would heartily recommend it, as it's a very informative and provocative read, and I'm sure will be very helpful to the ongoing discussions beyond this telecon series, as well as the discussion in general in society. So, Steve, we're delighted to have you with us, and over to you. The floor is yours.
Hello, can you hear me?
Hello, Steve. Yes, we can.
Okay, very good. Okay, I just I was unmuting myself there for a moment.
Okay.
Let me first thank you, Matt, for that generous introduction. What I want to do is to spend, you know, maybe 10 minutes talking about what the whole premise of Humanity 2.0 is. And let me start by saying what Humanity 1.0 is, because sometimes people ask me that question. And I would say that that is kind of the, you might say, the sort of taken-for-granted normative starting point of what it is to be a human being. It's the sort of thing that's enshrined in the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, for example. It's also a certain view about the human being that, let's say, the social sciences and the humanities have been traditionally about. And one of the things that, in a way, has made the human somewhat separate from, let's say, on the one hand, the biological, and on the other hand, the technological. Now, Humanity 2.0 is about blurring those sorts of boundaries that for at least 200 years have been used to define the human. And in my book, I talk about, first of all, why is the blurring happening now? And part of the story there, which I won't go into too much detail here, is that actually the nature of the human has always been a kind of unstable combination of the animal and the spiritual, which in the secular era, the spiritual tends to get more and more articulated in technological terms. And I think the easiest way to think about that, perhaps, is in terms of Ray Kurzweil's vision of the singularity as a kind of very extreme version of techno-theology or cyber immortality or whatever. But those impulses, in a way, have always been there. But I think now we're in a position where there are several kinds of alternative futures that are available to us. I'm not saying they're futures that are sort of immediately available to us in terms of just being able to realize them tomorrow, but I think in a sense what we are doing now is making various forms of mental preparation and adapting our values accordingly to possible worlds that we might be inhabiting. And so let me start by talking about what I think in the book, I characterize in the book as, you might say, the two most extreme options. One of them I've just alluded to, which is this kind of cyber immortality version, where in a sense the extreme version would be that we gradually abandon our carbon-based existence and we take the fact that human beings have been brought into the planet through long processes of evolution as just a kind of contingent fact. And that in order for us to promote what we value most about being human beings, we in a sense have to be creating as much distance from animals as possible. And so as a result, we would vacate our carbon-based existence and move increasingly into silicon or sort of some more durable form. And of course, Kurzweil is into uploading consciousness. But there are other sorts of versions of this kind of utopia, you might say, of what Humanity 2.0 could be. And so you might think of, for example, various forms of prosthetic extensions to the human body that enable us to, perform tasks more quickly, or to be able to, move better or whatever, or perhaps even some genetic switching that enables us to live indefinitely long lives and things along those lines, where there's serious biotechnological enhancement of the human condition that in a way defies the default tendencies that we were born with through evolutionary history. That's one possibility, and I think one way in which a lot of people have kind of voted in favor of that, you might say, is through the amount of time that they in fact spend in front of computers, and not only in front of computers, but using computer-based technology as a way of mediating normal social relations of all kinds, and that being, as it were, becoming the new environment that we inhabit. That's one vision. Now, the other extreme vision, in a way, would move us completely in the opposite direction. In other words, it would take us far away from any kind of technological spiritualization or anything of that sort, and would re-embed us back into nature. And the sort of standard bearer for that perspective is Peter Singer. And what I'm basically talking about here is the idea of treating the fact that we have the distinctive brains we have that are able to, you know, have these forms of consciousness and do all these marvelous things with science and so forth, that is really just also a contingent feature of evolution and is one that in a sense may be getting us into more trouble than it's worth from the standpoint of long-term carbon-based existence, especially in the company of other creatures who come from the same evolutionary history. And so what I'm saying, in other words, is thinking about a more ecologically sustainable world in which our value system becomes more in sync with the other creatures on the planet. And I think one very vivid way of illustrating that kind of vision of humanity 2.0 is to think about what Peter Singer and other people who are part of the animal liberation or animal rights movement consider to be the threshold of moral relevance. Because you might say that there's two ways of thinking about this. If you are of the belief that human beings, as it were, are morally relevant by virtue of their distinctiveness from animals, then you will tend to emphasize things like free will, autonomy, rationality, self-consciousness, reason giving, all those kinds of things. But if you're someone like Peter Singer and you believe that basically what makes us morally relevant is what make other animals morally relevant, then the moral threshold becomes the capacity to suffer pain. And then what you would do is you would organize your social life and your biological life in such a way as to minimize the capacity for the infliction of gratuitous pain. And that leads you in a completely different sort of world. It's a world that is more ecologically sustainable. It is one that would probably have fewer people, that would not just glorify the proliferation of humanity in whatever form. And it's one that I also think is a recognizable value system on the horizon. And there, too, that the value of human life would not be special. It would be the value of life itself. And so the capacity to live the best possible life you can as a particular kind of being will become more important than just promoting human life indefinitely. And as you know, people like Peter Singer do have views that are, you know, quite liberal on issues like abortion and euthanasia and so forth as a result. So in a sense, it would be re-embedding the human back into the natural and not creating the kind of distance that, in a sense, we've already gone down through the developments in science and technology and which the Kurzweil people would have us increase exponentially. Okay, so these are the two sort of radical alternatives that are on the table now. And I think, in a way, this is a kind of a distinction that, let's say, people of my generation, so I'm 52 years old, and I would say people of my generation and older still find both of them fairly science fictional, okay, or at least not quite realizable. But I do think that if we're talking about the younger generation, so the people who come after me and so forth, and what the politics is likely to be in the 21st century, my guess is that these two alternatives will become increasingly poles around which various forms of political interest and economic interest will be organized, and I think we're already beginning to see that happening. And I think in a way it also corresponds to the breakdown of a lot of the conventional categories of politics, which were very much focused on humanity 1.0. So when people ask me what's a typical political problem of humanity 1.0 that is kind of disappearing, I would say the problem of poverty. Okay? Not because there are no longer poor people in the world. On the contrary, I just think that there's a sense in which the kind of value system from which something like poverty came from, where you imagine that human beings, in order to live dignified lives, have to have certain material forms of their existence taken care of before they can move into some other plane of being, I don't think that kind of view, which was developed in the late 18th, early 19th century, is quite as salient any longer in the way of organizing the way we want society to be in the future. I think, in a sense, that kind of assumption no longer holds. I think it's a bit regrettable, to be honest with you, that it no longer holds, but I do think it's one of the things that accounts for the sort of aimlessness in politics today, is that, in a sense, these are not really the organizing categories that are giving meaning to people's existence. They're already, as it were, thinking in terms of one of these alternative visions of humanity 2.0. Would it be okay if I stop here?
That's fine, yes, Steve, if that's where you'd like to...
I mean, I think, because I don't want to go on forever, and I'm sure there's already a lot that I've said that people want to ask questions about.
Absolutely. Well, for those of you that have just joined the conversation and may have missed my housekeeping announcement at the beginning, we're also very keen to engage in some Q&A and discussion with Steve for the duration of the call. If you have a question that you'd like to raise, please do email me at my personal email address, matt.james@bioethics.ac.uk, and I can help manage the flow of conversations. But to kickstart things off, I think, if I may indulge by taking the first question, Steve, you've very helpfully explained Humanity 2.0 and how you see it. From my reading of not only your book, but other authors and materials, where do you think actually the Humanity 2.0 is focused on? Are we talking about changing the individual, or are we looking at changing communities? Where perhaps do you come from on that angle? Where do perhaps others that you know of that are writing and are thinking along these lines? Are we very much focused on the individual, or is any space given to how this might affect communities, collections of individuals?
Well, I think the first thing to be said about this is that the distinction between the individual and society, let's say, is a very Humanity 1.0 distinction, in the sense that the integrity of the individual and their relationship to the larger society, with the issues that have to do with possibility for empowerment and fears of domination, that is part of the Humanity 1.0, narrative, you might say, self-understanding. I think with Humanity 2.0, this question becomes really quite complicated, because there's an issue of what counts as an individual exactly, and I think this is a special problem for the kind of cyber version of Humanity 2.0, where in a sense, you might say that people who kind of go down that route become more and more comfortable with the idea of thinking of themselves as kind of a node in a network that in a way can be, as a site for enacting various different sorts of identities. Let's say you might think of them as avatars or something if you're playing Second Life. But in other words, that kind of idea of a stable individual identity that was so much part of Humanity 1.0, it seems to me that is kind of losing its focus in the kind of cyber version of Humanity 2.0. But at the same time, if you look at the sort of community side of things, there's a question of how is the community constituted? Because we're not really talking any longer about a sort of geographically localized place like a society that corresponds to a country with a fixed, location on Earth. But here we're talking about something much more dispersed and distributed, and where the boundaries of it aren't really clear, right? So what you have then are, as it were, individuals who are members of many overlapping communities, where the identities of that individual in the different communities might shift quite significantly over time. And I think in that kind of context, there are a lot of interesting issues about legal accountability that can be asked about this kind of emerging cyber world. Now, I think in the case of, a more animal-based, if we were to go down the more Peter Singer route, I think there is maybe more, because the Humanity 1.0 was very much focused on the individual as the biologically embodied individual, that in a way is a little more familiar. Singer's view would be a little more familiar in that sense. The individuality of the individual wouldn't necessarily be so valuable, right? It would be rather this individual's capacity to feel pain and pleasure and so forth. And so the kind of issues that were traditionally associated with free will and autonomy that caused the individual to be distinguished from the society, I don't think they're so salient in the sort of kind of ecological sustainability world of somebody like Peter Singer. I don't think those things matter so much any longer, but rather it's an ability to live in some kind of symbiotic relationship with other things. So I do think in both of these cases, the sort of classical view of the individual and society are very much challenged and blurred.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you very much. Just as other people are offering their comments and questions, without blurring, seeing we're talking about blurring of distinctions, blurring the conversation too much, I think you mentioned in your book clearly the impact of transhumanism and vis-a-vis posthumanism.
Yeah.
What do you think we can be taking from the transhumanist perspective in all of this as we think about Humanity 2.0 what are perhaps the strengths of their line of argument and the future in which they're envisaging, and perhaps the weaknesses that we can perhaps begin to think more clearly about and respond to.
Okay, that's a good question to bring up at this point, because I have a particular way of thinking about transhumanism and posthumanism, which I don't take to be the same thing. I think, in a way, posthumanism is the more general term, and basically posthumanism, you might say, is any kind of humanity 2.0 conception, might be called posthuman. But I think transhumanism is a very distinctive form of posthumanism that basically, you might say the Kurzweil thing fits into it, whereas the Singer version does not fit into it. And what I mean, see, transhumanism basically believes that that there are certain very valuable features about being a human being, and we might talk about our science and our technology and our reason and all these other things, our consciousness, whatever, and that in order for those things that we value most about human beings to be embodied in the most durable and effective way possible, we have to acquire another form of existence, or at least enhance the existence that we're currently in. Okay, that's what transhumanism is. So in a sense, transhumanism, you might say, is a kind of ultra-humanism. Okay, in other words, it wants to, it agrees with humanism that there are these distinctive features about being a human being that are worth promoting and preserving, but where it disagrees with traditional humanism is that the way to do it is through the ordinary biological human body. Now the term transhumanism was invented by Julian Huxley, the great-grandson of Thomas Henry Huxley, and Huxley was a major geneticist, and in fact even a eugenicist, and he believed that if you accept a Darwinian worldview, but at the same time you want to believe that human beings are somehow distinctive in that worldview, the position you're going to be led to, and this is how he would justify eugenics, for example, would be that we are the creature that, through some evolutionary accident perhaps, are now in a position to understand evolution and hence take control of it and steer it in various ways, whereas all the other creatures, as it were, have intelligences that are just adapted to the environments in which they live and within which they will reproduce. The thing about human beings is we can actually comprehend the whole scheme in principle. And as a result, we acquire a certain kind of stewardship over the whole thing that we can then use and steer in various ways. And Julian Huxley himself, spent a lot of the latter part of his life developing a kind of evolutionary humanism, which was his name for the transhumanism, which he tried to in various ways accommodate with radical Christian thinking of the sort of like Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, the sort of theistic evolutionist sort of person. And so that is kind of where the transhumanism comes from. But in more recent years, if we're talking about the transhumanism that has arisen as a result of the revolution in biotechnology, then it starts not so much from the eugenics standpoint, though I don't think that part of it has disappeared at all. I think that's still very much there. But it has started from this idea of enhancement, which is basically used to talk about the introduction of drugs and various kinds of therapies and treatments and so forth that can, as it were, use the human biological body as a kind of a baseline on which to build to come up with a kind of a creature that can actually do these things that we value in humanity much more efficiently and much more effectively. And some of that ends up blurring into prosthesis and androids and bionics and things of that kind. And that's the kind of transhumanism that is currently available now as a kind of ideology. And there's certain kinds of trends going on in our society today, so the sort of fascination with brain-boosting drugs and things like this. You might say this is part of the popular front of transhumanism. But I would also point to other kind of interesting developments, because you were earlier you were talking about the role of communities in this, and there is this whole community of people, relatively small now, but I think spreading and will become more important in the future, and this is the so-called open source biology movement, do-it-yourself biology. There was this book published by Harvard University Press by a woman named Hope called Bio Bazaar, which is about this kind of trend, a kind of an experimentation on creatures and sometimes even self-experimentation for purposes of exploring transhuman possibilities. And this is becoming, as it were, something that people, you know, as more and more people get at least some kind of amateur knowledge of, you know, biology and chemistry and things like this, that people are experimenting with, and there's anticipation that in the future, you know, people will want to, as it were, try out different transhuman possibilities on their own bodies. I mean, this is also part of the transhuman kind of ideology, you might say. It's one that is very much into what one of the transhumanist theorists, Max Moore, calls proactionary. You know, and proactionary is meant to be the sort of binary contrast to precautionary, right? So precautionary is this term that we associate with the sort of ecological sustainability where we sort of, as it were, err on the side of being conservative with regard to our interventions in nature because we don't want to destabilize the ecosystem too much. Well, the proactionary people, which the transhumanists are associated with, they tend to take a much risk-seeking approach. You know, and they in fact believe that part of what it is to be a human being is to be bold and adventurous and to be self-transformative in a way. And so there's that kind of, you might say, culture developing of transhumanism that even though the actual technologies on the ground may not be so great at the moment, nevertheless there's a kind of spirit of experimentation, even self-experimentation, that's developing along those lines.
Sure. Very interesting that some key points that you've mentioned in that response that I'd like to pick up on, namely focus around the whole issue of eugenics.
Yeah.
I think from a personal perspective, I believe this is a key issue that will more, no doubt resurface in the years to come with the very many new technologies that are coming out, interventions, enhancements, and the ability to select. How do you see that panning out as regards to humanity 2.0? I think I'm picking up that you'd probably be definitely on the lines of it is a pressing issue. Whether it was going to be termed eugenics or whether we'll come up with a new term that will effectively mean the same thing and try and sanitize it a little. But I definitely think it's an issue that's around the corner. How do you think we should be responding to that challenge?
Well, I think that's a very important point. First of all, I'm one of the people who's in favor of reviving the word eugenics because I do want people to learn the history of this.
Right.
Because I do think, you know, one of the points that you made in your question is quite right, namely, especially as the generations pass and you know, memories of what happened in the 20th century disappear, as the people who lived in that century disappear, I think it's very easy for everything to get relabeled in a way, right? And so one talks about genetic counseling, and that's seen as a fairly harmless and benevolent thing, and it can be, but I do think that the continuities with the history of eugenics are very much there, and are very much the same issues. To be sure, the science and technology that was involved in the original eugenics of the 20th century, and I'm not just talking about the Nazis, of course, I'm talking about what was going on in Scandinavia and Britain, United States, and lots of other places where there's enormous amount of research and very often a lot of clinical practice that was dedicated to this. In fact, you know, one of the striking things about the main book that's been written on the history of eugenics is that just about every major geneticist was involved in it in some way. Okay, maybe not directly on humans, but certainly with animals, and certainly that was seen as a long-term goal of genetics. And I don't believe any of that has changed now. What's changed is the science and technology has greatly improved. The interventions can be much more targeted. But also one other thing has changed, which I think is really important, and that is the politics of it has changed. I think if you look at the 20th century, whether we're talking about the more benign or the more malign uses of eugenics, one of the things that you would have to say about it is that for the most part, it involved a lot of state action, that it was a kind of a state-oriented thing, and very often, very much part of a conception of a generalized welfare state. Okay, and some of the socialism as well, and so the state was very heavily invested. And it was doing this on behalf of the people, and it was basically thinking about the human population. You know, in a way, I think the most productive way to think about eugenics is as a kind of an extension of something like agricultural policy only applied to humans. Okay, so for example, it's in this context that the phrase, you know, cultivating children, cultivating children, right? As if children were crops, right? This kind of way of speaking comes through the eugenics movement, which we still use today fairly unreflectively. But all of this was thought of in terms of the state as kind of the steward of this kind of collective property, right, that we can then breed in various ways to promote the population, et cetera, et cetera. And there were benign and malign versions of this. What's changed now, it seems to me, is that most of this, the development that's going on in eugenics is largely happening through commercial means with relatively little state governance or regulation. Okay? And so, in fact, what I talk about, and I've been talking about this now for several years, we live in what is effectively a bioliberal regime, where there's really just kind of regulation and control at the margins. But for the most part, you know, people are making their choices on the basis of whatever information they have about, you know, whether they, you know, what sort of, in terms of what sort of children they want. They can have various sorts of antenatal screenings, they can get various sorts of tests, but it's all very much done on an individual by individual basis, and there really are no well thought out state policies on this about the long term consequences of all of this capacity for genetic manipulation that may be able to happen at the individual decision making level. And see, from that standpoint, I would say that I would like the state to get more involved. Okay, I know that for some people that sounds horrific given the 20th century's track record, but I do think at the moment this is increasingly turning into a free market, the new eugenics.
Sure. Very interesting. I will not take up any more of time from anyone else. I believe we have a question from Nigel, who's coming from the States. Nigel, would you like to unmute yourself and pose your question to Steve? Nigel, are you there? Star zero, I believe, should be the key
question. Yes.
Are you there, Nigel? Okay, let me just see if I need to do something at my end. Ah. Nigel, are you there? Sorry, Steve, for this. Okay, well, I may just come back to Nigel shortly.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, there we go. There's Nigel there.
There we are. Sorry. Thank you. This is Nigel Cameron here in Boston. Steve, nice to hear you. It's been a while since you and I crossed.
Yes, I know. Yeah.
And I have not read the book, so maybe all the answers were in the book. And two comments. I mean, first, I just really appreciated what you've been saying about eugenics. It seems to me that nobody should be allowed to get a degree in science, you know, without 6 months immersion in the history of 20th century eugenics, which, of course, ironically, people tend to see as a Nazi enterprise, but it was a thoroughly Anglo-American project.
Yes.
Before Hitler discredited it. But my question would be, obviously you've been immersing yourself in some parallel conversations that really connect. I mean, I'm intrigued in the way in which you bring Peter Singer and the transhumanists into the same frame of reference. I mean, Singer and Kurzweil, who are in many ways rather similar individuals. I mean, they're both fixated with diet, among other things. Mm-hmm. But they are, you know, they tend to operate in completely different worlds. And as someone who's engaged with both of them, I mean, I love the way you're putting all the pieces on the table here. My question is, how you really see this playing out? Because, of course, in every generation, everyone has said that within 15 years, everything will have changed this way or other, that way. You know, we're going to have flying cars in the 50s and all that stuff. Given that the technologies, in fact, are proceeding much more slowly than most people predicted, in almost all areas, particularly the bio-related areas, given that, you know, we can't cure the common cold, let alone cancer and so on, how do you see this playing out, given that the transhumanists, from my point of view, have overplayed their hand? Which is one reason why I think they're trying to unbrand themselves somewhat now as trans and getting into the H-plus sort of model and trying to look a little bit more sort of connected to a more traditional conversation. But I mean, what's your thought about in 20-25 years' time? I mean, what do you think the state of the technology and of the social construction of the technology and its purpose is going to look like?
Oh, that's a good question.
Take a shot.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And in a way, one way to answer this is in terms of how I got into all this, and that's because I was involved with the European Union Framework 6 project on the Converging Technologies Agenda, which is this kind of meta-level science policy thing that fascinates people on both sides of the Atlantic. And it's a kind of a blueprint for where science as a whole ought to be going. And the answer is to enhance the human condition, with the word enhancement being used. So, in other words, the transhumanist language gets put into this very, you know, major science policy documents. The first one was put out by the U.S. National Science Foundation in 2002. And one of the authors of that document is a guy named William Sims Bainbridge, who is a sociologist of religion who specializes in questions involving cyber immortality. This guy happens to be the director of the Social Informatics Unit at the National Science Foundation. Okay? So in a sense, the transhumanist agenda has gotten very much into very serious policy circles. And of course, everybody realized that, realized in 2002 and still realized that the actual science and technology coming from this is still way behind the hype. Exactly right. But what is going on, and is that there's a lot of investment going on in this, and there's a lot of hope being generated, and quite deliberately, I would say. And here I think, Matt mentioned my association with the science and technology studies community, and in fact, the National Science Foundation, through its Nanotechnology and Society Initiative, has employed loads of social scientists of the science and technology variety to engage in various kinds of publicly oriented exercises of what gets called in the trade anticipatory governance. Anticipatory governance. In other words, you conduct focus groups, you get people working with scenarios, you get them involved in Wikimedia, you put them in citizens' juries to think about possible futures that involve various forms of enhancement using biotechnology, nanotechnology, and so forth. And in a way, what you do is you start to gauge where the people's fears, what their hopes are, what uses they think they might get from things. And this becomes kind of part of the mix, in a way, of creating a culture of expectation for this stuff, which at the very least keeps the money flowing for it, okay? Because I do agree that it may be quite a long time before we really see the kinds of things that would be recognizably transhuman in some very substantial way, but by the time that happens, there will have been a lot of expectation for it, and I would say a lot of acceptance for it once it arrives. So that's kind of how I see it playing out in the next generation or so, is yes, the innovations may come online much more slowly, but the expectations will be there and people will be prepared, and a lot of the fears that are currently being, people currently have about stuff like this, I think will in a way have been managed. And they won't be substantial. So in a sense, we're sort of paving the way now, you might say, for something like a transhumanist future. That's my view of the situation.
That's actually helpful. If I can add a little story that I don't know whether you know this. I was asked to testify at the European Group on Ethics some years ago, basically about that 2002 NSF document.
Mm-hmm.
And I assured these people that these were mid-level civil servants, like Adib or Bainbridge, who basically had bees in their bonnet and so on and so forth. The view being taken by the EGE was that this was George Bush, and these crazy Americans who were transhumanists. And I said it's rather difficult to understand how poor President Bush can be both completely anti-science and completely absorbed with science at the same time. You can't demonize the administration on both these counts successfully. But of course, that book was very much the product of individuals within the scientific civil service out in Boston, and their own initiative, and that project has gone into the sand. So I mean, it seems to me it's an interesting question how one generates the ideological conversation in the official science community.
Yes.
And one thing I'm delighted about your book, which is why I'm going to read it, having read Matt's review, is precisely because you're putting all these pieces together on the same board, which I think has not been done. But anyway, thank you very much. I appreciate your on where it's going.
No, thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Nigel. I believe Dr. Robert Song from Durham is also on the line, and he has a question. Robert, if you'd like to unmute yourself and pose your question.
Okay, is that working?
That's excellent, Robert. There you go.
Okay. Thanks very much. It's Robert Song here from Durham University. Just a couple of different kinds of questions, which are not as such directly connected with each other. There's one sort of story which is post-humanism and transhumanism, and the world is going forwards and ever upwards. There's another kind of story which is the story of environmental decline, economic chaos, and so on. I'd be very interested to know what you think, Steve, is the relationship between those two narratives, one of decline, one of expansion.
Well, I think, see, I don't really see the decline narrative very much. What I do see is the possibility, see, I think what often gets called the decline narrative overlooks the fact that if we were in that kind of state, probably our value system would change, and at least after a couple of generations, it wouldn't be recognized as a decline. I mean, because I think, for example, a lot of the people who argue for ecological sustainability are often seen as people who are advocating a kind of declinist mentality with regard to human beings. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's certainly how I would say, people on the transhumanist side would portray them. But I think what we're talking about in terms of downsizing the human condition is really kind of a value transformation, that the kinds of things that we currently value that we consider marks of our progress would no longer be so salient. They wouldn't matter so much anymore. They would be seen as just sort of artificial pipe dreams, not grounded in reality and the source of many of our problems. Because, see, the people who argue for transhumanism and the indefinite extension of the human condition, they tend to only look at one side of the balance sheet of the history of science and technology. I mean, they tend to look at the good stuff. And there's certainly been a lot of good stuff. But of course, there's also been a lot of bad stuff. And I think if one looks at it from a sort of an accounting standpoint, of the good against the bad, there's a real open question, unless we have really clear values, as to why we would think that the good outweighs the bad. You know, if we look at, let's say, you know, all the wars that have been made possible, all the amount of immiseration that's been created by enabling lots of people to live, but not to live in conditions that are adequate vis-a-vis their environments. I mean, there's lots of things that you could put on the doorstep of science and technology which would have to be attached to that, you know, infinite extension story. You see, so I do think you have to have the value system pretty well clarified. And what gets called declinist, I think, often kind of misses that point. So I see that in a sense you have two versions of what a better future would look like, but they're operating from two different value assumptions. And I think it's important that we see each value orientation in its own terms first before we start seeing how each looks from the other standpoint.
Okay. In that context, I mean, I noticed, again, I haven't read your book, but I noticed that you've got quite a lot on theology, which is...
Yes, that's right. It's very important. Yeah.
And I'm writing as a theologian about these issues.
Uh-huh.
Can you give me your take on theology and in relation
yes.
to humanity?
Okay. This is a really important part of the book, I think, and it's an important part of my thinking about this, because I think the transhumanist mentality is very much an extension of the idea that a theological kind of vision that really came to the fore during the Scientific Revolution by a lot of the sort of Protestant-oriented thinkers of the time, and so I'm thinking of especially Isaac Newton, but also Robert Boyle, people of that kind,
yeah.
where in a sense they take quite literally the idea that we are created in the image and likeness of God, and that one of the consequences of that is that that reality is in a very significant way mind-like, that in a sense we can understand the mind of God. We can get into that, and in a sense that is kind of the human entitlement. That is the way in which we raise ourselves above the animals, and maybe even a way to secure the path to salvation. And this involves a certain, what I associate with a very literal or at least univocal reading of the way in which God's being discussed, where God differs from us by degree rather than by kind. So when we say God is all-knowing, we mean that God knows much more than we do, but knowledge means the same thing in both cases.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so that's where I'm coming from. I think that's where the transhumanist perspective comes from, and it's ultimately a theological one, because I think one of the things, if you take the other perspective, the one that's more ecologically grounded and thinks of human beings as just animals, you have to ask, where do human beings get this kind of confidence from that they think that they can sort of blast off from their carbon-based existence, have complete knowledge of the universe, and, you know, move into these, you know, singularity things? Where does that kind of idea come from? Where does that confidence come from? And that confidence isn't just something created by the transhumanists. That, it seems to me, has been very much part of the narrative of science and technology as the progressive vanguard of the human condition, you know, for the last 300 or 400 years. And I see that as very profoundly theological. And so I go back and I talk a little bit about John Duns Scotus and his views of predication, and so I go into that kind of stuff as well, I mean, from the theological standpoint, because I do think that adds part of the backstory to this. I mean, one book you may be familiar with, and some of the people listening may want to follow this up, there was this very critical book that came out about 15 years ago by the historian David Noble called The Religion of Technology. The Religion of Technology, you may be familiar with this book.
Yeah.
Yes, well, this book basically, you might say, gives the prehistory of transhumanism, and does it from a very critical standpoint, because Noble is himself a bit of a Luddite, you might say.
Yes.
But I think even though my view about this history is much more positive than his view is, I basically think his history's right. It's just that he sees it as a tale of doom and gloom in the end, where human beings just become these very hubristic creatures that will, end up, sort of dominating the planet and causing endless misery. I don't actually see it as negatively as he does, but I do see the theological continuity with the transhumanist movement.
Yep. No, I'm absolutely with that in terms of the continuity. I have often traced back to Francis Bacon and so on.
Yes.
And absolutely with you about Duns Scotus and so on. I must admit, I thought the Noble book was a little bit about clever people and not recognizing how much the desires that we all have for self-transformation are actually very deep in are culturally deep, not just at the level of clever scientists.
No. See, I think, because if you look at the people he actually isolates in the book, he talks about Roger Bacon in the Middle Ages, right?
Yes.
And he talks about the early monasteries and the ways in which you can imagine them as kind of like agricultural stations, in a sense, right? With the way they're cultivating the landscape and so forth. And he's got some very interesting things to say about one of the people who's kind of a hero in my book, Joseph Priestley. Okay, so Joseph Priestley is a very interesting kind of transitional figure here, because he talks, he's a person who's clearly both a scientist and he's this, radical Unitarian minister, and he believes in a kind of resurrection of the body, and a lot of it kind of anticipates certain kinds of transhumanist fixations. And you see, Noble's got all that, and he also picks up on the fact that, people like Francis Collins from the Human Genome Project, is a born-again Christian, and he shows all the various Christians that have been involved in the history of genetics. Theodosius Dobzhansky is one that I talk about a lot in my book. He's one of the people who put together the neo-Darwinian synthesis between the natural history and the genetics, and he was a Russian Orthodox. And wrote this very interesting book toward the end of his life, which I would say is another kind of proto-transhumanist text with a kind of eugenics spin, is called The Biology of Ultimate Concern. I don't know if you've run across that book.
I haven't, no.
No, you should have a look at that, because he's very much influenced by the sort of existentialist theology that's in vogue at the time. But he's Russian Orthodox, and he appeals back to the concept of theosis in the Russian Orthodox Church, okay, where the idea that we, as it were, have a godlike moment, as it were, where we recognize our being in God. And that Dobzhansky associated with the scientific moment, very much as I think Newton and some of these other guys did in the past, and then he associated that with our, not only our ability, but in a way our obligation to become stewards of the human condition through a kind of benevolent eugenics. And so he was a president of the American Eugenics Society, for example. And you see, I think Noble picks up on all this kind of stuff, and I talk a lot about this in my book, about this part of the story, because I do think that's where you see the theology is not just some kind of 17th century thing or something that goes back to the Middle Ages, but something that continues to carry through into the modern era, into the quite recent past. But I think the trick here is that the way that theology carries through is in a very kind of, maybe heretical, dissenting kind of way. It's not a very church-based way.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that, and the people like N.F. Fedorov and so on, who are in similar ways dissenting or off-center in some kind of way. Because the interesting thing is that my perception is that mainstream theologians are pretty cautious, to say the least, about most post-humanist, transhumanist.
Oh, you better believe it. You better believe it, yeah. No, they fall back on a kind of standard natural law thing, right? A natural law thing supports humanity 1.0 to the max.
Well, there's another question. Is that a modernist idea, or is it a medieval Aristotelian idea?
Well, see, this is where I think you can end up getting some interesting common cause being made, because the people Because, see, I think one reason why there's been a kind of revival of natural law theory, I mean, part of it was through the Bush bioethics panel, as you probably know, right, where natural law theory was used to stop stem cell research, basically.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is because, you know, as I was saying in the beginning of my remarks, I think the kind of metaphysical basis for humanity 1.0 has become very destabilized as people have lost their faith in the Enlightenment project, you might say. And so, in a way, going back to these older Aristotelian, Thomistic kind of ideas of natural law versions of what a human being is, that in a way seems still more secure. The modernist kind of version of humanity 1.0 has been challenged a lot, but maybe the older version of humanity 1.0 from Aristotle and Thomas might actually be more secure from a metaphysical standpoint today. I don't know. But I think that's kind of why there's been a kind of revival of natural law going on.
Yep, I'm very much with that.
Excellent. Well, if I can just jump in there.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah.
Interesting and very helpful perspective. Thank you, Robert, and to Steve. Conscious of the time, not wanting to kind of test people's patience to the
limit. Oh, yeah, yeah.
What I think I'm going to do, I'm going to be cheeky and use my opportunity as chair to pose one last question that gives Steve the opportunity of answering it in some closing comments, reflections, as we draw the call to a close. Steve, in your book, and hearing you comment on this issue in other places as well, you make the very compelling and I think very necessary comment that, taking a kind of a step back now on a broader issue, the need for a blurring to occur, if it's not already occurring, to occur between traditional disciplinary boundaries.
Yes.
To help address the challenges humanity 2.0 and the things into the future. And I'd just like to open it up to you to perhaps close with this and any other comments you'd like to make. Why do you see that as being necessary? Because certainly in my work with BioCenter and other consultancy roles that I have, I see, without being ageist, a key enthusiasm for this amongst younger professionals and early career academics. And yet the more mature academics, professionals, are very reticent. They say, why do we have to be working across boundaries in order to come up with our issues? I am a scientist, I am a such and such, and I'm quite happy in my own domain. So I'd be interested to hear kind of your response, your comments on the need for this interdisciplinary partnership, as it were, as we head into the future, and then also just give you the floor finally to offer any concluding comments you'd like to make.
Well, I do think, you raise, there are two points here that I think are worth stressing, especially if the, as I talk to younger people, I emphasize this as well. I first of all think that these issues are going to play out increasingly in the years to come. So in a sense, I think we're just sort of in the beginning phases of this, and it does look a little science fictional at this point, but I think, this will be played out more. So this, in a sense, this is kind of a message to people who have yet to craft their careers. I think the interdisciplinary point comes from the fact that what we're talking about here is the definition of humanity. And if you go back to the early 19th century, when the modern university was kind of refounded by Wilhelm von Humboldt, and this whole idea that the university was about the completion of the Homo sapiens into the human being, the idea of Bildung, okay? The image of knowledge there was that all the different disciplines were synthesized in the individual to complete the human being. And so you might say the icon for that kind of vision of knowledge was Goethe, right, who was a poet and a scientist and a statesman. He integrated within himself all the disciplines and thereby became the exemplary human being. And the discipline of philosophy was supposed to provide that integrative role. And it did for a while. It doesn't do that anymore. It's now just one among many disciplines, unfortunately. But the whole point is that to become a human being in the modern conception of the university was to be the site for integrating the different forms of knowledge. Because each form of knowledge, as it were, gives you a different kind of opening into your being. And that you need them all together in some kind of integrated fashion in order to have the complete human. And so even though we're talking about humanity 2.0 and the directions in which this human being might go might be radically different from the way humans have been in the past, nevertheless the same principle applies, it seems to me. And I think what's changed is that now we are bringing in more disciplines that, in a sense, did not exist in the early 19th century when Humboldt was mapping out the nature of the university, right? So we have, for example, you know, massive amounts of technology that need to be incorporated as part of that interdisciplinary mix, for example, that was not even taken seriously in the early 19th century. And, of course, the developments in the natural sciences have also expanded tremendously, and they need to be part of the integration as well. Integration isn't just about integrating the humanities and social sciences, but it's about bringing these other disciplines in, because it's quite clear that whatever Humanity 2.0 is going to be, the natural sciences and technology are going to be integral to its definition. And it seems to me that's where the interdisciplinarity comes in. And I think the challenge for us now is to actually be able to design universities and other institutions of higher education that enable this kind of integration to occur on a regular basis. Because as you know, in the kind of world we're living in at the moment, disciplines are increasingly fragmented and balkanized, and as universities exist in a kind of free market environment, certain disciplines are allowed to grow and others are just allowed to wither away, regardless of their substantive contribution to this kind of question of Humanity 2.0. So I think that's kind of the challenge for us now, is to design institutions of education and research that enable this kind of integration that will be required as we move into the next phase of the kind of being we are.
Right. Excellent. Thank you very much for that. Any other concluding comments that you'd like to make before we go to a...
No, I just want to thank you for providing the opportunity and thank the interlocutors and listeners and so forth. And, if people want to contact me by email or whatever, I invite them to read the book too. But in any case, I thank you for the opportunity.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. I know from comments that have been coming through, not necessarily questions but comments, that are very stimulating and very helpful hours at Telecom with you. So thank you very much. I heartily recommend Steve's book. It will provoke and inspire you. And as I say, I'm not employed by him, but it's a jolly good book, so make sure you pick up a copy at some point. One last thing, just a final plug, we join again for a Telecon series, the next in this Thought Leader series, with Justina Robson, leading science fiction author here in the UK, at 3 o'clock on Friday. Please do email me all details for that. I'm sure that will be another interesting afternoon's discussion. And finally, once again, thanks, Steve. Thank you very much. I'm sure we've not done the matter justice in an hour, but I'm certain that it's provided.
Well, I'm looking forward to it being online, because I think people, listening to it again, I think a lot of the important issues of the book did get raised very effectively by the various callers.
Absolutely, and I will make sure that everyone who signed up this afternoon will get an email with a link to the audio file once it's uploaded. Okay, thank you very much, everyone, and thank you once again, Steve, for your participation this afternoon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Matt James
has left the conference.